Hello, and welcome to Season 2, Episode 15 of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee with Dr. Justin Winzenberg and me, Stephen Jones. In this episode, Justin and I continue our conversation about deconstruction, doubt, and faith from Episode 14. If you haven't listened to Episode 14 yet, that might be worth doing before you jump into today's episode. Before we get started, though, this episode is being published in the week after the killings of 8 people in Georgia, including 6 Asian American women. I don't know if there's a right way to address this awful loss and the pain that has brought the families. We also know that pain is being felt acutely by many in the broader Asian American communities, and we wanted to take a moment to sit with you in that pain and loss.
Well, what was a highlight for you this week?
I mean, it feels like kind of a hard week for highlights, but
yeah,
I can share this. I'm enjoying a very nice coffee that my that our barista makes, and it's a bespoke coffee. It's the Chiabolical Latte is what he calls it.
Right? Oh, right.
Which I don't think it's a latte. It's just, well, it's chai, you know, chai tea, and it's got espresso and some cream in it. It's very nice. Also, the dog, just before we started recording, found Jenny's coffee and drank about half of it.
No way. No way. Yeah.
And so, yeah, so she's a little bit wired. The dog is. Jenny is less wired as a consequence.
Yeah. No way.
Yeah, I didn't know dogs liked coffee, but apparently
I didn't either. So, didn't either.
How about for you? What's the highlight been?
I've been listening to this podcast, the True Tunes podcast, and they just recently came out with an episode where the guy who runs the podcast actually had a chance to interview one of my favorite musicians of all time. But this interview is like from 1995, and it's of the musician Rich Mullins.
Oh, and nice.
I've maybe talked about Rich before on the podcast, but it's a 2-episode thing where he actually uncovered a lost interview that he had taped way back in the day, and he found it again or was able to restore it.
So there's the interview portion.
Yeah. There's an interview portion with Rich, which, by the way, it is so, in a lot of ways, culturally relevant. relevant because as early as 1994, 95, maybe it was 95, Rich is really speaking out prophetically against some of the trends in evangelical communities. Mm-hmm. And he's very much so kind of a, what would you call him? Like a, not so much an outsider, because, you know, he had a way to speak into that environment in a way that was doing it kind of from the inside, even though he's kind of, you know, considered fringe by some. But mm-hmm. anyhow, I thought it was extremely fascinating that he was saying things that I'm like, man, this is so relevant now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we'll put a link to that in the show notes.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's a low light been for you?
Man, I mean, the events that have been happening lately in the world as it relates to the shootings in Atlanta, as well as the abduction of the woman Sarah Everett and in London. I mean, those kinds of things are just, I don't really know how to piece these things together as a man. In both cases, it was women who were assaulted and murdered. And I'm just feeling for folks, for women, for our Asian American brothers and sisters who I know that the way that they're living in the world is sometimes a different experience from the life that I've been handed. And mm-hmm. I just want to try my best to empathize and understand. I mean, both instances are so tragic and painful. And I'm at a loss of words, but they're terrible.
Yeah.
What about for you?
Yeah, I think.
I'm sorry, maybe I should have said more about that. I don't know. I what do you think?
No, I don't. I think, you know, in some ways, in addition to and compounding those events are just the sometimes awful uses of words by people who are, you know, who look like and are situated like we are, right? Mm-hmm. And particularly white Christian men who are just, yeah, sometimes being really awful in the ways that we engage. And I mean, I've been thinking for a long time about the witness of the church, you know, and what are we bearing witness to? And I think often we bear witness to, I mean, certainly to the need for redemption, but it, sometimes in just really terrible ways. I'm thinking about how we, So last episode and this episode, we're talking about deconstructing faith, right? And like, what's that core? And I think there's some hope in that, but gosh, sometimes when I see the way that the faith as represented by people like us expresses itself publicly, I think, well, yeah, no wonder people walk away from it,
yeah. Right?
Or run away from it or try to dismiss it or, you know, because I think... Yeah. And I mean,
are there particular voices you've been hearing, not meaning calling out the people necessarily, but what are some of the things you're hearing that are making you cringe in terms of the, or is that not worth naming?
I think it's not worth naming at the moment because I don't necessarily want to give it voice, but
yeah, that's true. Cause I'm hearing similar things and I don't have a great Twitter presence or anything. And that's really the only social media thing that I'm on with any frequency. And I don't really know, I kind of feel like, man, there are all these voices out there, these white male, you know, often evangelical voices who are saying things that are just brutal. I don't know. They need to be called out on the one hand, and they are being called out. And that's, I think, why I'm like, okay, I'm not going to say anything publicly because others are doing a much better job calling it out than I would anyways. But I'm in agreement with a lot of those folks who are calling it out and exposing the how terrible it is. Mm-hmm. And I think you're right in a lot of ways, you know, it's understandable when that's what people think is faith, then for them to run from it.
Yeah.
100% justifiable even.
It is because it's like, Yeah. And then at the same time, I think, gosh, even though I think it's really justifiable that people would run away from it and even oppose it, gosh, it breaks my heart because there's something so real and true about Jesus, and we're getting in the way of that. And I wish that we didn't get in the way of Christ. And yet, I mean, he chooses to work through us, right? I don't get it. Sometimes I'm like, why? Cause like we make such a mess of it. And I think sometimes we say that dismissively, like, oh yeah, we make a mess of it. And like, you know, God's evidently fine with it. Like I don't think he is fine with it, you know, with the mess we make of it. But I think,
well, in a lot of ways, you know, it's always been that way. That's not to justify any of it, but to say this, like you look actually back at the first century church and in church, throughout church history, what a mess. But there always are, I think, these prophetic voices to call out and call back.
Right.
And so in some ways it's like, yeah, I think you're right in terms of the way that us folks as white men have often represented in the current era. Man, well, not just the current era.
For a while, right?
Yeah. For a while, man, it's not the right path. And it's like, but there are other voices, man, calling out. And I feel like that's in some ways reflective of the voice of Jesus, mm-hmm. you know, that reflects that Jesus that you said. How did you put it? There's something,
I don't know, true, beautiful
yeah. about Jesus. And I think that beauty is expressed in that, in those call outs.
Mm-hmm. I think
and
so.
And they've always been there in a lot of ways. You know, as early as the early church, you're getting call outs like that too.
Yeah.
And it continues to this day.
One of my profs used to talk about how God never leaves his people without a witness. And you look mm-hmm. at any point in church history and there is always this prophetic voice calling the church back, you know, calling it out. Say, no, that's not the gospel. You know, no, that's not the right expression. Like, yeah. And you see it at the very beginning, obviously with Paul and Peter and James and, you know, this calling out saying, no, like,
and Priscilla and Aquila, I mean, they're confronting Apollos even, and confronting is probably maybe not the right word. They're certainly informing, teaching, mm-hmm. correcting. Yeah. Is there more insight in there then that you'd like to raise?
I don't think so. I think I just need to sit in the pain of it. And like, I was talking with a friend yesterday and I'm like, I have not actually yet felt the pain. I'm aware of it. I know it's coming.
Yeah.
But I haven't yet felt the pain related to the events of the week. You know, and part of that, there's just kind of this numbness, I think, but I think I just need to sit with it and also to be very vigilant against everything that is about defending myself.
Yeah.
And I think that because I think that's what I see is so maybe that's the insight. If there is one, is just that I don't need to look at events like what's happened in the last week with,
it's hard. I've noticed, you know, as I'm following Twitter feeds and stuff that like there's the academic in me too, that wants to parse out conversations and explain. And then I'm realizing, you know, and I had a conversation with a friend this last week where it became apparent to me that kind of default mode in me can become very unhelpful, especially in situations like this, where that's just not an appropriate response at this time. And so I think that's important.
We'll be back in a moment with the second half of our discussion about deconstruction, doubt, and faith. As always, you can find out more at profsandrooms.com or at patreon.com/profsandrooms.
So how far in your process of deconstruction, did you ever feel like your faith itself was at risk?
Yeah, I did. I mean, there was one point in particular when I was in school here that I did, but that wasn't something that was, it's like I was sitting in a class. I've told this story to students as well, but I was sitting in a class and a professor said something and it just hit me in a way that caused all sorts of questions and doubts. And it wasn't the professor, I don't think, was actually trying to destroy my faith by any means.
You're saying he wasn't trained to?
No. Oh, no way. No. I mean, we know this professor. We work with this professor.
That's better.
No. And I love him, and he's a dear guy, you know, but what caused me to do is have all sorts of questions that I couldn't answer at the time. And I remember going back to my dorm and just feeling a sense of like things, maybe I'll never be the same again. Mm. And there's just the seed that got planted in my brain that so made that, me
that's
question
interesting
and doubt.
You were talking about deconstruction really happening after your time at Brown, but it sounds like there was this moment of something happening even while you were in this.
It was, that's true. That's true. I think of most of the deconstruction I went through happened after I left college. But in this particular instance, because I would say this, because of what happened to me in this instance, mm-hmm. I didn't really experience that same kind of thing that you're talking about after college. Meaning this, that when the deconstruction was happening to me after college and when I was going through that, it never really led to a point where I thought my faith would be gone. Mm. And some of it was because I'd gone through an experience like that and kind of come out on the other side of it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I just remember even waking up one morning wondering whether I'd have to leave school. At that point, some of my best friends were here. I mean, I had my whole career path and I didn't even know where I was going in a career, but the major I was involved in, all of that was based on my believing in the scriptures. Mm. And when I didn't know if I could believe that necessarily, I kind of thought maybe I'd have to leave school, which was a terrifying thought because, like I said, but some of my best friends were here. And I ended up getting through the process. I didn't snap out of it overnight by any means, but because I think I came through that process without my faith actually being destroyed,
it
meant that when I faced similar things in the future, they weren't quite as frightening to me.
What do you think it was? Because I think somebody could say, well, you just found a way to rationalize your faith because you didn't want to lose your friends and your career path. Yeah.
Someone saying that.
Is there a different story for what that process was?
Yeah, there is. At the core of the struggle for me was, can I trust anything the Bible has to say? And really what happened to me wasn't that I went and said, well, I don't want to believe the answer is no, because if I do, I'd have to leave my friends and leave my major. That really wasn't it. I was ready to do it. I was like, fine, if this is all hogwash, I'm out of here because I'm not going to waste my time.
Yep.
So it was scary. It was fearful. I didn't want to say bye to my friends.
Yep.
It was scary, but I was ready to do it because I'm like, I'm not going to sit around here and study this stuff if it's just a big joke.
Yeah.
What actually, so there is a different story. And the story was that what I started to realize was that the things I believed about the scripture were based on some false assumptions that if those assumptions weren't true, it actually led to there being more beauty in the scriptures than I had imagined. And so I had this sort of idea that somehow God must have needed to dictate the words to the individual authors, and they just literally heard it in their ear and wrote it down. Mm. And when I realized that wasn't what had actually happened, that there's some of the personality of the authors in these texts, it scared me. And then it made me realize, well, wait a second. Like, you know, if we follow the narrative of scripture, God's always done that. God's always worked through imperfect human beings. Like God has always preferred to work through imperfect human beings than to send out a booming voice from heaven saying, thus saith the Lord, you know,
and which then speaks actually, to that beauty that you're talking about, right?
That's what I'm meaning. So what it caused me to do is actually see God in a new light that didn't destroy my faith, but that actually built it up and encouraged it. I'm like, wait a second, like this is actually a beautiful thing. It's a risky thing. It's a terribly risky thing using imperfect human beings. It would be much preferable if we had a narrative in mainline Christianity that fit along the lines of Mormonism. Because if we just had golden tablets that God wrote and that some prophet needed to come and translate or something, that's a much cleaner story. But that's not what we have. We've got human beings who wrote texts that we count as the word of God, which means that human beings who are erroneous and who make mistakes, you know, are the same people writing these. And that can be scary. But then for me, this moment just dawned on me eventually where I was like, wait a second. Like, yeah, I mean, that's the biblical narrative there. Mm-hmm. I would prefer God just booming the voice from heaven and giving us the golden tablets again, but apparently didn't work very well the first time. Remember Moses coming up from the mountain and crashing those things? It is a funny thing. You know, even you get the tablets, you know, the Ten Commandment tablets, and those things, like, they got lost. Like, so the first ones Moses destroyed, the second ones they throw in the Ark of the Covenant, and where the Ark of the Covenant is to this day, no one knows.
Yeah, I think Indiana Jones is working on that, right?
It got lost, meaning the tablets themselves, the message didn't, right? We still got, you know, manuscripts of Deuteronomy and everything in Exodus and whatnot. But, and, you know, so the story is more complicated for me. It's that I don't think my motivation was, well, geez, this is just too risky. So I want to believe a false narrative, self-deceived myself just to kind of prevent me from losing my friends.
Well, and in some ways, then the continuing exercise of revisiting those foundations in your grad work and continuing to challenge gave you opportunity to push on that further.
Sometimes what I wonder, it'd be interesting to get your take on this. Like, there are times where I look back on my life when I was 19 and I had a faith that was based on some of those kind of, that was much more latching onto some of those cultural forms that I've now seen as unhelpful. Mm-hmm. I look back though, and I kind of see the ways I've practice my faith and whatnot as actually almost somewhat idyllic still. Mm. And I kind of miss some of those days because maybe it's because of the feelings that came along with it. Right. It's like, because I equated so much of vibrant faith with performing certain spiritual disciplines and all that. And now my life is way messier than that. I wonder, like, I just think sometimes, like, I don't know how to put this, and maybe it doesn't belong here, but I don't feel as spiritual sometimes as I did then. Mm-hmm. Is that the truth? Or is that just because I'm not equating it with the things that I think counted as spirituality?
It's interesting. I mean, I think one of the things that I find really comforting is the stories of other followers of Jesus who've gone before, who have walked through sometimes decades of, you know, whether you want to call it a dry spell or, you know, St. John of the Cross talks about the dark night of the soul. And I think there's something really beautiful actually in that move away from loving God, trusting God because of what he gives us in terms of the feelings. You know, sometimes there's that manifest presence of God. It's not something that we can reliably conjure up, right? It's something that has to be given. It's And so then when we walk through seasons where God feels distant, and sometimes really long seasons, those stories of other faithful Christians. And I think that this is part of the thing for me. I don't know, part of what I hope to do for my students is to build a resiliency in faith by not making faith too safe, by deconstructing some of those foundations that are unhealthy, you know, and there's all sorts of different unhealthy foundations. Yeah. But to say, like, I feel like for me, there's this, and I can't remember if we've talked about this on a, I don't think we've talked about this on a podcast, but I feel like I had a moment where, okay, you know how the Hulk has the moment where he's like, I'm angry all the time. Yeah. Or, you know what I'm talking about?
What moment did you say?
So the Hulk has this moment where he's like, I'm always angry. The secret. Oh, what is this? This is in, it's in one of the Avengers movies.
Oh, no, sorry, I haven't seen any of them.
Oh, okay. All right. So yeah, you have no idea what I'm talking about. Okay. So it's like, it's how he's managing his Hulk self, right?
Yeah.
Like,
okay. Yeah.
And you know, before there was this idea of like, he should keep himself from being angry. And if keep himself from being angry, then he's safe. Hmm. And then there's this transformation moment and he reveals that actually he's learned how to be angry all the time. And
interesting
to control that. And I feel like in some ways there's this corresponding thing with doubt. Right. That like in kind of this, I don't know, early faith, doubt feels very unwelcome, very like
threatening. Yeah.
Yeah. Like what we have to do is get rid of doubt. Mm-hmm. and then we're okay. And I feel like there's this moment where it's like, no, doubt is a constant companion, but doubt is the context in which faith is possible. And I think that's different than being one who, because, you know, there's this, I think James talks about, you know, don't ask as one who doubts, you know, because then you're double-minded. I think that's a different idea than this idea that, you know, yeah, I could be wrong. That is constantly possible. And I think even in terms of the implications of this are huge, like how we interact with society, like the reality that I could be wrong, if that's a constant companion, it causes me to move with hopefully more humility of saying, yeah, I don't know the ways in which I'm wrong. And your faith kind of moves in some ways. It becomes, this sounds backwards, but it's almost like it becomes smaller and smaller and smaller until it's down. It's almost like it becomes reduced to a mustard seed, right? That Jesus talks about.
That's interesting.
Because like my faith was in an understanding of what it means to be a Christian as an American, with an understanding of certain ontologies and certain epistemologies. And as those different things have been cut away, what is left is something that's actually quite small, but precious, right? Like that pearl of great price, right? That you go and you sell, you sell everything you have to buy the field for this one little, this one little nugget of truth. And I think for me, that is my experience of faith, that like, I kind of am always aware of the possibility that maybe this isn't true. I'm kind of always aware of the possibility that maybe, that maybe we don't have it right, which means that I don't have that same sense of being completely okay that I felt sometimes in earlier stages of my faith, which feels like kind of that nostalgic feeling that you're talking about.
Yeah. And I think that what you're bringing up, this idea too of anger, like that is a big part of a lot of people's experience of deconstruction, where I think the feelings of being mad, being really pissed off at people, at the church, like I that seems to be a common thread for people whose faith have been deconstructed. And the question, the difference between how can you go through those periods and still stay angry while not losing your faith? And it's like, the question is in some ways, well, what is our anger geared at? Because if our anger is geared at the systems that perpetuate this hogwash that has caused all sorts of conflations of faith with this or that, which isn't actually faith, and faith in Christ, well, then I think it's a justified anger. And then but the problem is it's hard to feel spiritual while you're angry.
Yeah.
And yet sometimes it is in fact, quote unquote, spiritual to be angry at the things that are deserving to be angry at. Right. And so I think when people experience that oftentimes they can lead to, of course, to this unhealthy cynicism. Mm-hmm. It can lead to the sense of like, just I'm done with it, but it can also lead to this sense of like reform.
Yeah. And I think that this is where that, so the Dark Night of the Soul, one of the observations about it is that it's this opportunity to move into, do I know God? Do I love God because God is good or because of what God gives me? Right. And I think in the same kind of vein, this deconstruction down to this very small but precious faith is like, if I don't know anything other than Jesus, is that enough? Right. And I think that's that core intuition of like, the beauty of Jesus, the beauty. And so for me, I had a moment where I felt like my faith was at risk, and it had to do with, if I really take seriously people from other faiths and I understand that they actually mean their faith sometimes more than I do, and sometimes are more altruistic in the expression of their faith than I am, then what do I do with that? Like how, and I don't necessarily have a full set of answers to that, but there was this moment where I felt like I was gonna walk away, or like I could, right? Like the door was open, but there was one thing that I could not get past, and that was love, and how the Jesus of the Bible, right? That Jesus is the embodiment of love in a way that I just don't see anywhere else. And I'm not saying like sometimes people say, well, you know, if you don't know Jesus, you can't really love. I think that's ridiculous. I know people who don't know Jesus who love incredibly well.
Exactly.
But I do think there is something about Jesus of the Bible that is an embodiment of love that I can't find anywhere else.
Yeah.
As we prepare to go overseas, there's this risk of elevating us. And I feel that already. And I think about, so we spoke in church on Sunday and it was good. I felt good about it. The week leading up to that was really hard. And it wasn't, some of it had to do with the church service, things we had to prepare for that. Some of it had to do with dissertation, of course, and you know, yeah. all that stuff. And I just, but there was a moment where I was literally laying on the floor, like, I can't do this.
Oh man.
And I think
I've been there. No, I have, man. I'm so glad you're talking about it because, you know, you're a college professor, you're a future missionary, and yeah. you go through moments where you're laying on the floor and you're stuck and you don't know what to do. Like, that's real life.
And so to act like somehow because I'm confident that God has called us into the next stage that we're moving into, that somehow that means that we don't have moments of weakness. It's more like, I mean, my prayer out of that is, God, you said to Paul that your strength was made perfect in weakness. So I have some weakness for you to work with, right?
And you're bringing that up. That's 2 Corinthians, man. 2 Corinthians has become one of my favorite books because I think the idea sometimes that's perpetuated is, well, if you want to go be a missionary somewhere, we want to know right now, are you extremely energized and feeling absolutely spiritually vibrant? And if you're not, well, then we have some concerns and maybe you shouldn't be going to the field or something like that. And it's like, here's the reality, man, the call to carry the torch of Jesus's message and ministry to the world is a call irrespective of whether we're feeling great about it, or whether we're feeling spiritually vibrant or not. And the truth is there may be more times when you're called to be gospel witnesses in their moments of weakness than you are in moments of strength. And that's 2 Corinthians. Like, Paul just boasts in this ironic boast, because it's not really a boast. It's a lame boast, but this ironic boast of like, oh, you want proof of the validity of the message? See it in the fact that we're the scum of the earth. See it in the fact that we're weak. See it in the fact that we're weak and Christ is strong. And it's like, you get this impression in 2 Corinthians more than anywhere else that Paul's ministry was most often done out of weakness and within weakness than it was with strength. And to me, then I'm like, that makes sense for me when I have to go to class and I have to talk about the scriptures and talk about Jesus when I'm feeling depressed or when I'm feeling like I don't got the energy to, but I can't just say, you know, I'm going to wait till the epiphany comes and then I'll get back to the task. Like, and it's not even just about the job, the task of the job. It's the task of the bigger task. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, if our life is a call to carry the torch, we're doing it at all moments, especially when we're weak.
Right. And that also reminds me, is it Galatians 6 maybe where Paul, is there a Galatians 6?
Yep, there is.
Yeah. Okay. Is that where Paul says, if I boast, let it be in Christ crucified?
Yep.
But yeah. I think that idea that our boast is in Christ and Him crucified. It's not in my ability to live always knowing that I've got it put together. It's not in my ability to say, hey, I never have doubts. It's really the opposite. It's like, in spite of my doubt, I know Jesus. I know the crucified and risen Christ. And I'm not even always 100% confident in my knowledge of that, but His Spirit testifies to my spirit that we know Him, right? Like, that's that Romans 8, right?
Yep. You're talking about deconstruction. Were there any moments when you're laying on the floor there thinking, I'm not sure I should do this? This meaning go speak at church?
No.
Good. Because here's what I'm wondering. What in the world? This is the deconstructing the faith. What in the world has ever led us to believe that that might be true? Because I've had those thoughts. I've had those thoughts where you're in a moment of weakness, or you're depressed, or you're down, or life is just hard. And I have thoughts sometimes of like, can I do this? Can I speak? I said I would speak in church 4 months ago, and now the day is coming on and I'm not feeling like I got the energy and I've got,
you know,
and yet there's something built in me that's saying, should I be doing this? And
sometimes,
I'm like, I think that feeling's wrong.
I think it is sometimes. Okay. So yes and no. Like if I push through, here's the risk. If I push through in the flesh, in my own strength, then what comes out often is not love. This is where I think the risk of, so when I'm a prof and I walk into a room and I am in one of those moments of weakness, and if I teach in the flesh, in the old man, right, then my attempts to help students wrestle with deconstruction may very well be an exercise in self-gratification for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
If on the other hand, I walk in and I'm like, Lord, I got nothing. Mm-hmm. Those have honestly been some of my best moments teaching, because sometimes Jesus shows up and it's a beautiful thing. And what happens in that class period is something I never could have built. Mm. I don't know if that makes sense.
No, it does. Totally does. But this is kind of the plight of people in full-time ministry, although it's not true. I was going to say this is kind of true of pastors, but there's really no reason why a pastor couldn't show up on a Sunday and say, sorry, no message this week. We're doing something else. Now there is in our modern church format that sure. We literally don't know of anything else to do other than have that sermon and the music. Not that there couldn't be other alternatives, right? Mm-hmm. But for us in the world of like teaching, you don't really have a lot of options. I remember I can't just show up and say class is canceled.
Right.
Now I do remember a moment though, man, it's a powerful moment with a professor I had a lot of respect for here when I was a student, and he came to class, and apparently he'd been up all night, you know, with a family whose father, I think, was dying of cancer. And he just came to class and he was just like, I can't do this today. And we didn't cancel class, but we like talked with him. Mm-hmm. And it's like, he wasn't looking for a counsel. It wasn't a counseling session, but it was like, just this honest, like, I can't do this today. And I don't know what else we can do, but here's the reason why. And it led to some conversation. It was powerful.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's like I saw the sense of vulnerability with one of my professors who I really looked up to, not as a look at this weak, poor fellow who I shouldn't trust now, but it gave me even more a sense of like, man, this guy's legit. Like this is a guy who's not afraid to, you know, who's not afraid to admit. My buddies and I, every now and then we talk about that moment, because it was a powerful example, I think, that was that really stuck with me at the time. But I think that's kind of what that can happen in ministry a lot, though, this pressure almost of like, well, I'm not allowed to let the guard down, you know?
So as you think about this kind of contemporary moment of people wrestling with deconstruction, what hope do you have?
My hope is that the facade of Christendom that has been invented in certain forms in America get blown to smithereens. The danger.
To put it mildly.
it's true. And that doesn't mean a culture less Christianity. It can't mean that.
No.
But I think what it would mean is the refusal to continue to conflate certain ideas that have been perpetuated as promoted by Jesus or as a necessity for Christians, that really is not that at all. Mm-hmm. And so if those things get blown to smithereens, man, good riddance. I mean, I think good to see them go. The danger though, is that there's so many of us who have thought that's equivalent to faith, that we don't know faith apart from that.
Right.
What that means then is that when people reject that, they often then are saying, well, then Jesus must be bogus and the Bible must be bogus and my faith must be bogus. The actual hope then isn't just that those things get blown to smithereens. It's that in the midst of those things necessarily needing to get blown to smithereens, that a genuine faith would emerge for people.
Amen.
But I think though what happens, and I think sometimes when people are in those dark moments of where it's just been blown to smithereens and there is no faith remaining, you know, that's not going to necessarily always have a lot of say for people. So my hope is those moments where people have allowed those things to get blown to smithereens and they're in a current place where they feel like there's no faith remaining, those moments don't always have the last say. My hope is that people who've gone through that can rediscover, if not now, sometime in the future, rediscover and re-explore what faith is and what faith in Jesus is when those things are gone. Now, I think, though, that sometimes what happens is people are just so fed up with anything with the word Jesus in it or anything like that, or fed up with, because the Bible's been used as a weapon in those environments, then they want to avoid the Bible. And in a lot of ways, I don't blame them. Mm-hmm. But in some ways, my hope would be that actually they could revisit the scriptures, revisit Jesus, and see if there's still something there, in spite of all those things getting blown to smithereens.
I'm reminded of 1 Peter. It talks about this idea that our faith is more valuable than gold, mm-hmm. that it's tested by fire, right? This idea that there is something very... I feel like I struggle for a word here. It's like there's something that is so precious, so valuable, so worthy, so weighty, but all of the dross has to be brought out of it. Right. Yeah. And I think that that's my hope, that in a moment of deconstruction, in a moment of, of tearing down things that are false, that true thing, that the weighty thing, that the beautiful thing would remain and would be cleansed, to be purified. And I think that that doesn't necessarily mean that we end up rebuilding. Well, I'm sure that it doesn't mean that we end up rebuilding the house the way it looked before. I think it means that we were left with something really precious.
So what would you call Jesus followers to?
This might sound kind of hokey. I don't know, but I think it's to trust Jesus enough to present our faith to him for refinement. Mm. So to say, Lord, whatever it is that I am attached to that isn't of you, would you cleanse me of that? If I have a faith in something that isn't worthy of my faith, would you strip me of that? And I think a lot of times he does that much more gently than it doesn't necessarily feel gentle, but I think he's very patient with us. I think if it all happened at once, it would be so overwhelming. It's overwhelming as it is, but I think that something that I've talked about for a number of years is this idea that God is not afraid of the questions that I have. And that when we take those wrestlings seriously, one of the things that we can expect is that actually he is already present in the midst of them. So whether it's the question of human suffering, whether it's the question of horrible things that have been done in the name of the church, whatever that issue is that you're wrestling with, expect that God is actually there in the midst of that question. I think sometimes we use those questions as a way of running away from God, but if we're honest about it, God is more concerned about this. And we see that in Revelation 2 and 3, right? Like he's deeply present in our mess. And if we look for him there, we'll find him. And so I think that would be my hope for Jesus followers, my call to Jesus followers is expect to find him, trust him enough to find him in the midst of the wrestling.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm thinking for me, it's along some similar lines, but I thought of a metaphor, how I feel like a lot of people, when they first start dating, they build up their boyfriend or girlfriend into a kind of person that isn't actually the real them.
Yeah, that never existed.
It's the person who's the figment of their imagination, whom they very much so probably latch onto and or reject. And so some people actually, quit dating a person because not because of who they are, but of who they imagine them to be at that moment. But it can go the other way, of course, where people will latch on and really fall in love with a person that's a figment of their imagination, and then they get married, and then guess what? At some point, the real person emerges.
Yeah.
And that can lead to two things. It can lead to destruction, and it can lead to marriages crumbling, or it can lead to something extremely beautiful where you then can learn to embrace the real person, who oftentimes is far more beautiful than the figment of your imagination, because they're real human being. And I think this is why I thought about this, because if I have one hope for the church and for followers of Jesus, it would be that they allow the Jesus of the figment of their imagination to be blown to smithereens, which is scary.
It's terrifying.
It's as necessary to have happen as it is for young married couples to allow their spouse that figment of their imagination of their spouse to be blown to smithereens. Mm-hmm. But the hope would be not that they're left with nothing, but that the real Jesus emerges with more beauty than they could have ever imagined. Mm-hmm. And that all that other junk that they thought he was can finally be kind of thrown to the wayside.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's a hope. It sounds harsh. So you thought yours was corny. Well, if mine's maybe not corny, mine might be too rough, but it is. And we're all in need of it. Like me too.
Yep.
Right? Because there's a certain scent where the Jesus that I've appreciated and latched onto has as much been at times a figment of my imagination than it is of a Jesus we encounter in the scriptures and in real life. I don't know. Mm-hmm. To me, that can be scary, but it can be liberating. But not liberating because you're left aimless or left with a destroyed faith, but because I think a deeper faith can emerge from that in a way that's impossible as long as we allow the Jesus who is the figment of our imagination to continue to exist.
I really like that picture. Yeah. I mean, I remember realizing, and it was disturbing. I remember realizing that Jenny wasn't who I thought she was after we got married, but the person that I married to is so much more amazing than the person I thought I'd married.
Yeah. Well, and for me, I remember dating in my 20s and always coming to the realization at some point, as I'm sure they did with me, that like, oh, this person is more human than I maybe had thought they were when I was living in the high castle of the perfect person, you know? And I think what I realized then was actually it's far better to date and to be with a real human being than it is to be with that image that I made of them as this idyllic person. Mm-hmm. It's harder. Right? Because then what you get in arguments with that person, you know, it's harder because you don't agree with that person, the real person on everything, you know, but as long as we kind of keep them built up as this idyllic person who isn't actually real, like that's not helpful for a relationship.
Thank you for joining us for today's episode. Our regular theme music is by Josiah Enns. Today's theme music is used under license. Reed Peters is a recognized patron of the show. We hope you can join us for coffee again next time.